Hi, I'm David Brancaccio in for Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of October 28th. Families struggle in today's economy. Are we due for a new look at who's poor and who isn't?
There was a time in America when you didn't worry so much about out-of-pocket health care costs. You know, you spent 5 or 6% of your income on it, and it took care of it, and it was a different world.
New poverty numbers and high spending and little savings. Wonder how that one turned out?
There was an old Onion headline. America demands new bubble to invest in. I hope we don't do that.
Consumers are tapped out. Is it businesses' turn to spend? Plus, healthcare costs are rising while people are losing their jobs. We'll look at how one accident turned into a mountain of medical debt.
Millions of people, they may not know this, but they are just one accident or one illness away from disaster.
The domino effect of hospital fees. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Our struggle with money and debt. This hour will come at that challenge from a variety of angles, but let's start with the poorest Americans. Officially, the poverty line for a single parent with two kids is a little under $18,000. Whether you live in an expensive city or in a cheaper rural area, regardless of your health or whether or not you get food stamps, for the past 50 years, none of that counted when figuring out who is poor. But the government is about to make some changes. Until now, the poverty line was drawn by taking the cost of basic food needs and multiplying times three.
And we've kept it that way since 1960 and increased it only for prices.
Tim Smeeting is the director of the Institute for Research on Poverty. He says back then, food was a third of an American family's expenses.
Now, if you come to today, food is 1/7 of the annual budget of most people. So it's time for something new.
Next week, the census releases new numbers that take a different look at poverty. They'll consider the whole picture, a family's needs as well as their resources. So the census will subtract the cost of child care and commuting, but it'll also add the benefits a family receives, like food stamps and tax credits. Take Denise Chapman, for example, whose income hovers just above the old poverty line. She works full-time for the rescue mission of Trenton, New Jersey, driving former addicts around town.
And this is Montgomery. And I'm going to take this Montgomery to get to Perry.
On this Monday morning, she took three people to the hospital, two people to the dentist, a man to welfare, and then picked up some donations before heading back. She uses the mission's van, which is good because her own Chevy Venture has been broken down for a month. From the sounds of it, she'll need a new transmission, which could cost hundreds.
Yeah, that's what my dad said. But I said, if it is, then I would just junk it because I can't afford to put all this money in a van and then something else go wrong with it.
You don't have hundreds lying around for a transmission?
No, I don't. I don't have no hundreds, actually, not let alone lying around.
Chapman makes less than $12 an hour, so hundreds of dollars is a week's paycheck. Her job pays for her health insurance, but that does not cover copays.
I have diabetes, I got high blood pressure, my cholesterol. I can't afford that medicine.
So that's where the state steps in to pick up the tab for the copays.
So I thank God that I get the New Jersey Family Care.
She benefits from New Jersey Family Care because she has two kids and is considered by the state a low-income parent. But many poor Americans are stuck with those costs, and according to Tim Smeeting, the poverty expert, that makes a huge dent in people's personal finances.
There was a time in America when you didn't worry so much about out-of-pocket health care costs, and that was about 1960. Back then, you know, you spent 5 or 6% of your income on it, and it took care of it, and it was a different world.
Under the old system, Chapman's income puts her 30% above the poverty line, but under the new census guidelines, she might be classified as poor. Sure, those medical copay benefits will make Denise Chapman look richer on paper, but keep in mind, she lives in one of the most expensive states in the country. Life in New Jersey means she's actually much poorer, again, on paper. And let's face it, in the real world, she is struggling.
What you getting for the store, Mama?
Denise Chapman is standing outside her new apartment. The rent is $700, about half of what she takes home each month. Her kitchen appliances are decent, but the house next door is abandoned. And Denise says drug users go in and out.
I watch them every day. I don't care if they see me or not. I still watch them because I got to be careful for me and my kids.
But her main problem with the neighborhood isn't safety. It's the schools. She'd like to move to a better school district for the sake of her straight-A daughter. But right now, that's not a choice she can afford, even if officially she's not quite poor. Mary Gay Abbott Young is Chapman's boss at the rescue mission, and she wonders if being just above the poverty line is really good enough anyway.
If you live here, where I wouldn't want to live, if you eat at this place, where I wouldn't want to eat, and if you send your children to this school that my kids would never go to, is that really the standard we want to hold?
But in Denise Chapman's view, poverty is relative. She says just look at her clients at the mission.
I don't consider myself as poor, but I know that I am. But I look at their situation and say, oh no, I'm doing a little bit better than them. And that's how I get by life every day.
In 2010, 47 million Americans were living in poverty, the highest number in more than half a century. When these new additions and subtractions from the Census Bureau are mixed into the poverty figures next week, the number of officially poor households in America will likely rise. Policymakers will use the new system to better evaluate and target programs to try to do a better job lifting people up the economic ladder. The financial crisis in Greece has driven unemployment there to more than 16%. Joblessness among young Greeks is more than twice that rate, so it's no surprise that 70% of Greeks under the age of 40 want to move abroad. Joanna Kakissis has the story of three friends who are leaving the country.
It's a warm October morning in central Athens. Two men are loading a stove, a kitchen table, and a mirror into a big moving van parked outside an apartment building. The furniture belongs to Elena Stylianidi and her Italian husband, Francesco. They're both architects in their early 30s. In a few days, they move to Italy. Elena would rather stay close to her family, but she's been unemployed for 7 months.
I started to understand that I can't find no more jobs. And I started to realize that it was getting really worse and I had to do something about it.
Her husband Francesco said Greece was a different place 6 years ago when he moved to Athens.
I came here in 2005 and I started work immediately. I mean, there was a big economical boom. It was really easy to find a job.
Francesco learned to speak Greek fluently. For 4 years, he and Elena lived well and planned for a long future here. 2 years ago, their son Stefano was born. But that same year, the debt crisis began. Suddenly, work dried up, and they burned through all of their savings. Yanni Saplauras is their closest friend. He's in a similar position. He's 33 and a mathematician with a master's degree. But the best job he's been able to find is part-time work at a bookstore. He plans to join Elena and Francesco in Italy. It's hopeless in Greece, he says.
I mean, yeah, I know a lot of people searching for a job for months and they find nothing. They're desperate. I mean, they don't know what to do. Most of them are thinking to go abroad, like us.
Francesco and Elena have already lined up jobs in Italy, and they're helping Yanis find work. But Francesco says things aren't much better there.
My family will help us a bit in Italy, so it's an easier choice. But I've no restriction for the future. We can't think about Italy, Europe. We have to think to our life, our family, our job, everything, and not so much to where we will be.
Francesco and Elena have no idea how long they'll be in Italy. Elena says she'd like to return to Greece, but she's read that it will take at least a decade for the country to recover from its crippling recession.
It's really difficult for me to understand how it's going to stop, when it's going to stop, how it's going to change. So I hope it's going to take less than 10 years because I would like to return one day here.
Francesco and Yanis leave to run errands, and Elena is left in the empty apartment alone. She unlocks the door to greet a neighbor. "We're leaving," she says. "Yes," he replies, "I know. These are difficult times." In Athens, I'm Joanna Kakissis for Marketplace Money.
Now, let's be clear. You don't have to go nearly as far as Greece to get whipsawed by this economic downturn. There was word at the end of the week that personal income in the U.S. went up just a sliver last month, an increase of 0.1%. Tight budgets in the U.S. mean folks aren't spending much money, which then hits businesses. And then those businesses don't necessarily want to hire people. So how do you change that? Commentator Megan Dom wants you to think of one word. It's a squishy one. Marshmallows.
Remember the famous Stanford marshmallow experiment of 1972? It's the one that studied the development of delayed gratification skills by asking preschoolers to choose between eating a marshmallow right away or waiting. If they did wait, they'd get two marshmallows. As you might imagine, some just couldn't help themselves and popped the thing in their mouth. Others made strenuous efforts to resist temptation. They hid their eyes and kicked the desks. One little girl even stroked the marshmallow as though it were a small, furry animal. These children were followed through the 1980s, and the data showed that the high delayers, the ones who held out and got two marshmallows, had more social and academic success and even got higher SAT scores than their low-delaying peers. And guess what? Recent data from these kids, now in their 40s, suggest that their brains are wired in such a way that this is a lifelong pattern. So, that great American success mantra, sacrifice now, benefit later, isn't just a platitude you hear from parents and finance gurus. It's been scientifically proven. But today, in the wake of low consumer demand, it's not just high achievers that are exhibiting willpower. It's everyone. And that leads to a certain irony, namely that the behavior most associated with personal prosperity, delayed gratification, is now perpetuating our national lack of it. Does that mean that an army of low-delaying marshmallow eaters can save the economy by hitting the malls and buying a bunch of stuff on credit? Probably not. But every economy needs its instant gratification seekers. We need some folks to splurge when others are saving, to take risky business ventures. For every Warren Buffett who's probably hoarding marshmallows in his Omaha garage, we need a Donald Trump who may well be pumping marshmallow fluff into his veins at all times. In other words, high delayers with their impressive SAT scores and successful outcomes may be good for some things. But let's face it, what the world needs now are the kids who stuffed their faces without thinking. Or at least some better-tasting marshmallows. Otherwise, it's a rocky road indeed.
Megan Dom is a columnist for the LA Times. For more on those prudent marshmallow eaters, i.e. savers, check out the insights of personal finance blogger Barbara Friedberg on our Making Money blog. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm David Brancaccio, sitting in for Tess Vigeland. I've been waiting weeks to do this again. Nothing like a bracing round of conversations with people who need some money help. Bringing some rigor to the proceedings is Liz Weston, personal finance columnist for MSN. Hello, Liz.
Hey, how you doing, David?
I'm doing well. You know, not long ago, the Federal Reserve Chairman said that Congress needs to find what he called a path to the future to deal with the housing market. And we're still waiting for Congress. But in lieu of those folks, President Obama's been trying some things. This week, he launched a plan that seeks to let maybe a million or more homeowners save some money on their mortgages, even if those loans are underwater, is the phrase. Now, Liz, you've been watching this carefully. How does it work? This is for people, right, who have been paying their mortgage on time.
Yes. And one of the frustrations they've had is that they haven't been able to take advantage of these incredibly low rates that we're experiencing. And what this change to the program will do is take away the limit on how far underwater they can be. In the past, you couldn't be more than 125% underwater to get help under the government program. A lot of lenders were even limiting it further to 105%. Now those limits have been taken away. A lot of the obstacles that were thrown up in the way of refinancing these loans have been either reduced or eliminated. So this is a program that might actually help a few people.
You think something like this can make a difference? It's going to about double the number of people, maybe a little bit more than that, but almost double the amount of people who would be eligible eligible. Is that big enough to shift the housing market?
Probably not. I mean, if we had done this 5 years ago, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, it might have made a huge impact. Here, it's going to help, you know, not a handful of homeowners. We're looking anywhere between 800,000 and 1.6 million homeowners could take advantage of this. It is going to free up some money so that they can do other things. You still have that question of, should you continue to pay on a deeply underwater mortgage? Is it better to just walk away and start over? I mean, that's the question they'll still have to face. But I'm assuming that people who have paid their mortgage and stayed current to this point probably will want to just refinance, lock it in, and you know, move on from there.
But this is where we are in 2010. A grown-up personal finance expert like yourself even includes among the list of possibilities making that tough decision of maybe it just doesn't make financial sense to keep paying on an asset that just isn't worth anything close to the loan.
Well, I have to say, if you are struggling to pay that mortgage and you're not getting any help, that's something that you have to look at. I think a lot of us would have trouble walking away from a mortgage we can afford. But if you're struggling and you can't get help, that's something that should go into the calculus.
All right. Now, watch this. We're going to move from the general to the very specific. And a wonderful woman named Marcy in Bremen, Georgia, is going to help us do just that. Hello, Marcy.
Hey, how are you?
Where's Bremen, by the way, in Georgia?
Bremen. You have to say it the right way.
I was
worried
about that. So it would be Bremen, Germany, but in Bremen, Georgia.
Yeah, well, actually, we are 11 miles from the Alabama border, so it's directly due west of Atlanta.
You know why I should have suspected that it would be Bremen? I'm from the state of Maine.
Oh, my favorite state.
Yeah, well, you know, there's not Madrid up there. There's Madrid.
Of course.
And it's not Calais up there in the north. It's Calais. So I should you should be more careful. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
All right. So, Marcy, tell us, what do you do there?
Well, actually, what I do is I work in Atlanta at Emory University in Atlanta and commute in.
And even though I understand you're a spring chicken, you are thinking in the not too distant future, still measured in years, of maybe about retirement?
Well, that is actually my whole, to be honest with you, dilemma about this lovely old house that, of course, I purchased with my heart, not my mind. I mean, I'm seriously underwater on the mortgage, and I'm making my payments. It's not that I'm behind. It's not that I'm not responsible. It's if I'm looking in 2 years at possibly relocating or I'm going to actually affect a retirement plan, I am never going to get back what I owe on this property. And I've had many, many people say, you need to probably just look into walking away.
We were just talking about this notion of walking away. So before we get quite there as an option, when did you buy the house and what did you pay?
I bought in 2004. I paid, once the finance charges were rolled in, around $150,000.
And then you thought maybe at some point it might you might do well to refi. Why?
Here's why. When I bought the property, that particular loan instrument was one of those oddball ones where 2 years later it was going to be an 11% interest where the initial interest was 4%. And so I set about, of course, refinancing in 2006, which I did very successfully.
So you were worried about the mortgage payment ballooning because the interest rates would shift. And so it seems rational that you'd want to refinance into something that might be a little lower or more stable.
Correct. And it was. I didn't anticipate the appraisal to come back as ridiculously high as it did.
What did it come back as?
It came back in 2006 at $265,000. I mean, it's a lovely old house, but I was like, really? Then for another set of reasons, I refinanced in December of 2009.
So, Marcy, let me ask you, what do you owe now on the house and what do you think it's worth?
My total indebtedness on the property right now is right around $200,000. My gut tells me the house is probably worth about $100,000.
Okay. Here's what we're facing is that you do not qualify for the new HARP program, the changes that we were talking about. And that's because you did your last refi in December of 2009. The cutoff is for June.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So really what you're facing is, you know, keeping it, trying to make the payments, short sale or foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, short sale and foreclosure have about the same effect on your credit score. It's going to take years to recover from that.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit to a short sale if you can get one, is that you would be able to buy another house within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Liz, just remind us, a short sale is when you agree with the lender that you should sell for whatever price you can get, and then that'll be it.
Yeah, basically that's how it works. You sell the house for less than what you owe. And there are complications after that because sometimes the lender wants to keep you on the hook for that debt. That has to be something you negotiate. The good news is you don't have to pay taxes if the debt is forgiven. There's a federal law passed that excuses you from the taxes on a primary residence when you do a short sale. Or a foreclosure, I believe.
Liz, how would Marcy get started if she opted for the short sale? Is that a call to the lender? Is that how that starts?
Well, I actually would start. I would go back one more step. I would talk to a HUD-approved housing counselor because there may be an option here that I don't know about. Go to HUD.gov, mm-hmm. Find a referral there. And then with the short sale, you certainly have real estate agents in your area mm-hmm. that are very comfortable, very familiar with both your lender and your situation and can advise you on that.
Yeah.
Well, best of luck to you.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, let's go to our next call. This one, Vienna, the other Vienna, the Vienna that's outside Washington, D.C. Hello, Kevin.
Hey, how's it going?
How can we help you out here?
Okay, so I graduated from college not too long ago, and I know that saving for retirement is really important, but I'm wondering, is it more important to save for retirement or save for something like a down payment on a home?
So wait, Kevin, how old are you actually? You're like 22 or something?
Yes, I'm 22.
And what is it about your upbringing that damaged you to the point that you are actually worried about retirement at 22?
When I got my first job, I started getting kind of interested in personal finance. Like everywhere on personal finance blogs, everybody's always talking about like save early and often for retirement. It's sort of always been an issue of, how much to save for retirement rather than like whether or not to save.
So how much are you saving?
At the moment, I'm saving about 50% of what I make.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my high savings target is sort of a function of the past decade, all these baby boomers retiring, and all the headlines are saying that people don't have enough save for retirement. And so it's very much at the front of my mind when I'm thinking about what to save for.
So Liz, at this stage, I mean, Kevin's like the perfect man. He's doing what he's supposed to do, right?
Yeah, I was one of those weirdos who also saved a lot in my 20s. And I'll tell you what, it gives you a lot of freedom later. So hats off to you. So you're maxing out your 401k. Are you contributing to a Roth?
Yeah, at the moment, I'm lucky enough to have a 401k through my employer that you can do the after-tax Roth. And so I'm maxing out my Roth 401k. And then I'm also contributing to a Roth IRA of my own.
Are you contributing any pre-tax money?
Not at the moment. I mean, I've basically been looking into this a little bit. Sounds like the best bet is to sort of take advantage of low tax rates while you're younger and
right.
Not making as much money.
Okay, that's cool. I was just thinking that down the road, you will probably want to take advantage of that tax break because you'll be in a higher tax bracket. And you want to have
right.
money in different buckets when you get to retirement. You want to have some that's taxable, some that's not taxable. It gives you more flexibility. But you know all that. So the decision is, should you keep going the way you're going or should you start putting money aside for what, a down payment? Is that what you're thinking of?
Right, yeah, because the money that I'm putting into retirement accounts right now, I know I can't touch it for like 40, 45 years. On the one hand, I'm thinking, if I keep saving for retirement, then I'll be totally set. But, 5 or 10 years down the line, I might not have enough money for a down payment on a house. But on the other hand, if I, save a lot now for a house, like in 40 years, I might hate myself for not saving more for retirement.
You got like a vision of the ghost of Christmas future. There was a version of Kevin from when you're older, chastising you for not even saving enough?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, there are all these people who talk about how they wish that they had started saving for retirement when they were in their 20s. So, I mean, I'm just trying to avoid that at all costs so I don't, put myself in a bad place a couple of decades from now.
But your essential question here is this. You're not going to give up on savings, but your question is, should you save a portion in something that's more readily accessible in a few years in case you wanted to buy a house?
Right. So, I mean, what I'm sort of considering doing is, cutting what I'm saving for retirement by maybe a half or even more than that. I'm sort of starting to think, do I really need to save that much at this point when I'm, just out of school?
Well, you need to save that much if you want to retire when you're 40. But assuming that you don't, I think that cutting back would be fine. I think I wouldn't go 2/3. I'd go maybe half and then start piling the money up in other places for a down payment, say. Now, the thing is, you're so young, you probably don't, unless you're absolutely positive that you know where you want to live for the next 10 years, a home purchase may not be a great idea. You know, we used to say 5 years, now we're saying 10. Just because you need to be there long enough to get some price appreciation so you can overcome the cost of selling the house and moving.
Right. Yeah, well, thank you for the permission to go ahead and maybe cut back a little bit if I'd like to save for something more immediate.
There you go.
World's most responsible human being, Kevin in Vienna, Virginia.
Love
on her. Track on track to retiring at the age of 29, it sounds like. Kevin, thank you.
I appreciate the advice.
Now let's talk to David from Boston, Massachusetts. Hello, David.
How you doing?
Good. Love the name. What do you do in the Boston area?
Commercial real estate.
Whereabouts?
North of Boston, basically North Shore.
So, David, what's your question?
I bought a condo 4 or 5 years ago. I have a daughter now, and the place is a little small. We're looking to get out of it, and you know, we apparently bought it not such a good time, and we're just trying to make the right moves to get out of where we are sooner and get into a bigger place, and I was just looking for some guidance on what's the smartest thing to do with my money to achieve that.
So how did that happen that you bought at a not-so-great price? Because you kind of know the real estate market where you work, but you misjudged it where you ended up buying?
It's a pretty real estate's pretty local, and I was looking at a few communities that I was quite familiar with, and then a few others that I wasn't as familiar with, and where we ended up was maybe more of a marginal area, and home prices went south, and now we're certainly owe more than the house is worth. And what I'm trying to figure out is, you know, with the extra cash I have, should I be paying the principal down? Should I be putting it aside for a house fund for later? You know, where should my 401k be at? Cause I don't want to completely lose sight of retirement in the meantime. So I'm just trying to figure out what's the best use between now and, say, 2 years, which is really probably as long as I could hold off in my current arrangement.
Okay, so you could pay the loan down enough to where you could sell it without doing a short sale. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, that's the objective.
Okay, and the cash is not in a retirement account. It's somewhere that's accessible. You wouldn't be paying any penalties to get at it, right?
Exactly, yeah. So we have basically like a house savings account and then an emergency fund, which we have certainly tried not to touch.
And how are you doing on retirement savings? Do you feel like you're on track?
No, I don't. I mean, I think I was up at about 14% of my salary before we started really realizing we need to get out of our housing situation. Now I'm down to about 8%. My wife has 11% coming out of her check into a pension, but I don't think I'm on track. I just had to scale it back.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, if it were me, I'd find a fee-only financial planner to go over the whole situation, because there are so many moving parts here. I don't know how much you've got saved for retirement already, so I don't know if this, you know, if you're kind of behind and trying to catch up. It sounds like that's a bit the case.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I probably have 75 maybe.
Okay. And are you guys, you would move now if you could? Is that basically the situation?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we would.
Okay. You know, sometimes it's worth just biting the bullet, paying down the mortgage, getting it sold, and getting on with your life. The advantage of that is you're not going to suffer the credit score damage that you would if you tried to do a short sale. And that
right.
that will affect you for at least 2 years. You know, if you go into foreclosure, as we talked earlier, it can affect you up to 7. Really trashes your credit scores. And if you've got the cash, that might be the best way to deploy it. But I would like to have a financial planner who is paid only by the fees I pay, not commissions or anything else, to look at the whole situation and give you some advice, because that's what I would do in the situation.
Are there a group, are these people available, like financial planners who you know, don't deal really with high net worth people, just with a regular average Joe?
Yeah, there's a group called the Garrett Planning Network. They're fee only. They charge by the hour, and it's Garrett with 2 R's and 2 T's. There are other groups. And one is NAPFA, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors. But they do tend to skew to the high net worth folks.
David, what would be your best case scenario? Maybe if you did pay down the mortgage, you got out of it. What, rent for a while because you don't have a down payment anymore and then start saving again?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I mean, that's why I'm trying to, at this point, I'm trying to save to make up for where I'm, how much I'm underwater. And also, I'm figuring in 2 years, I'll hopefully have enough to pay down what I'm underwater on my initial loan and have a reasonable down payment on the new place. That's why I keep giving it this 2-year time frame. But I'm wondering, you know, in the meantime, if I have say, $30,000 in a house fund right now. And does it make more sense for me to just drop that on principal, or should I just have it sit in cash?
Well, here's my concern, David, about waiting too long is, you know, we don't know that the real estate market recession is over. And I don't know what the market is like where you are, but we're not done with the foreclosures. You could be basically, you know, chasing it down, as it were, chasing down the balance if you put this decision off for too long. Maybe it's better to, you know, just pull the cord now, rent for a couple years. Because again, if prices are going to continue to fall, there's really no disadvantage to waiting. I don't see interest rates, you know, soaring in the next couple of years. A lot of places, prices are going to continue to fall. So maybe just regrouping for a couple of years might be the best option.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're here to take your money questions anytime. You can call us. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, if you spell money, M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Liz Weston, the personal finance columnist at MSN, thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.
Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. You think of debt. You think of a 5-year car loan or maybe a 30-year mortgage. I'm about to talk to a professor who looks at debt through the millennia. David Graeber is an anthropologist at Goldsmiths University of London who had a hand in the early organization of the Occupy Wall Street protests. His new book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, goes deep into the question of if we really, really have to pay back what we owe. Professor Graeber, thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Of course, it's morally wrong not to pay your debts back. I mean, your folks didn't teach you that?
Well, one of the things I discovered when looking at history is that people always say that, but in practice, it's not really the case. Especially people on the top of the food chain, they know that everything's negotiable. The strict morality of debt tends to be for the little people.
But it's so deeply ingrained. Here, you may have heard the following lines. The actor is Al Pacino. The screenwriter is William Shakespeare.
The pound of flesh that I demand of him is dearly bought. 'Tis mine. 'Tis mine!
And I will have it. I mean, the person who wants his money back is traditionally seen as a person who needs to get his money back.
And he's also the villain, isn't he? That's the fascinating thing. Throughout human history, people have tried to reconcile two completely irreconcilable ideas. Morality is paying your debts. Moneylenders are evil.
So we love credit. We just don't often love the image of the person we owe the money to.
Precisely.
But this notion of that you're a bad person if you don't pay your debts back, you're saying is actually up for discussion?
Absolutely. I mean, a debt is a promise. It's a certain type of promise. It's a promise that can be quantified, and it's therefore a promise that can be transferred to other people.
But a debt is a contract. And it's argued quite persuasively, I have to say, that rule of law and enforceable contracts are what allowed us to achieve the standards of living that we have. Yes, contract law is not a law of physics. It is a human construct. But by accepting contract law, a lot of good flowed from it.
Certainly. But there's contract law and there's contract law. Throughout human history, debts have been renegotiated. In fact, most of the most successful civilizations in human history always had some way of readjusting debts so that you don't end up in a situation where the big people end up effectively enslaving the little people. In Mesopotamia, for example, they had debt cancellation. It was almost a systematic thing. Every new king who would come in would say, all right, clean slate, start over again. The biblical Jubilee was the same thing. Every 7 years, debts would be canceled.
Are there good uses of debt?
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of small-scale communities in Africa, for example, where it's just considered right that everybody should owe each other a little. So there are some places where debt and sociality are really the same thing.
The term you're using is sociality.
Yeah, the idea that everybody should have links to each other. And debt was a way of making that real.
You point out that a lot of very familiar English words actually descend from this idea of debt.
Yes, reckoning, redemption, even phrases like a person of no account or worthy. They all go back to credit, because when you don't have the state enforcing a debt, well, then debts take on a whole different color. One's honor, one's decency, and one's credit are basically the same thing. So whereas for us, if you spend money helping the poor, that's probably going to lower your credit rating because you're going to be more likely to miss a house mortgage payment. For most of human history, if you were a decent person and were generous, that would actually improve your credit.
So there's debt as social capital, and there's also if you borrow some money to do something worthy like investing in plant and equipment to make medicines to cure tropical diseases. But there's also this other kind of debt, quite familiar to many Americans, and it sounds a lot like this from the 2009 movie Confessions of a Shopaholic.
Rebecca Bloomwood, occupation, journalist. Jacket, Visa. Dress, Amex. Belt, MasterCard. It's vintage, and I got 1% cash back.
Gee, without debt, she doesn't have any self-image at all.
Well, in a way, credit has come to substitute for what used to be community.
And so it's no longer a kind of social glue, a kind of social capital. It's something else.
The fact that we want to buy a beer for our friends, the fact that we want to have a party for our children, that we want to take care of each other, suddenly brings people in a situation where they're in constant fear and looking over their shoulders because they're in hock for their lives.
So what's this? You have an idea maybe another one of these biblical jubilees might be in order, a mass debt forgiveness? What do you think?
I think it wouldn't be a bad idea, and I've got a lot of criticism for this, and it's a provocative idea, but I think we should at least think about it, because I think we're using an antiquated idea of what money is. If money is just a credit system, it's a series of promises. Well, promises, by definition, can be renegotiated.
But why? To get people out of this cycle of having to serve the debt that they owe and to do something perhaps more productive?
Yes, I think that would free up a lot of energies of people doing things that they don't really want to be doing and work that doesn't even really need to be done.
Look, if you could engineer a jubilee and I wouldn't have to pay off the rest of my mortgage and the credit card debt I still owe, I'll be first in line for that. Fabulous at first. But the thing is, right? No one would ever lend again. People lend for a lot of reasons, but they especially lend to make an informed bet on the borrower's future. It's a way of turning my honor as a kind of guy that would pay back into ready cash. And that's just going to dry up credit into the future.
Well, that's what people always say. But in fact, in the past, that's not been the case, because what are people going to do with their money? The money doesn't really exist unless you lend it. Banks make up money by making loans. If they don't make loans, there's no bank.
The front doors of the United States Federal Reserve are down at 20th and Constitution Avenue in D.C. Mm-hmm. I'll meet you down there. We can see how far we get.
Yeah.
We'll have a chat. All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
David Graeber is an anthropologist at Goldsmiths, University of London. The book, Debt, the First 5,000 Years. Now, from an anthropologist's view of getting out of debt to an economist's view of the way forward, namely, how do we build the U.S. economy without relying on another debt-driven bubble? You may remember the bubble, real estate prices that always seem to go up, leading to home equity loans galore and a splurge of spending. Austin Goolsbee is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago. Until late this summer, he was the chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Professor Goolsbee, welcome to the program.
Hey, my pleasure.
Here's what a wise man once told me. We had an economy based on buying things we don't need, using money we don't have, made somewhere else. Do you see any truth in that epigram?
You know, there's some grain of truth in that. There's no question that in the 2000s, we had an economic expansion that was fueled by consumer spending and housing construction, neither of which was sustainable.
Maybe it's a cycle. Give the economy some time and we'll start building houses again, buying houses, furnishing houses, and happy times can be here again.
There was an old Onion headline, America demands new bubble to invest in. I hope we don't do that. Our consumer spending was growing faster than our income, and that brought our national savings rate at 3 points in the 2000s to less than zero. So if you added up all the savings of everyone in the United States combined, it was less than nothing.
So in a sense, we've gone through the looking glass already. Something is now different with the economy. Maybe what? We should think about it in a new way? Less just waiting for the consumer to stand up and salute?
Yeah, I think a little bit that. And there's still in the economics community a big argument about, were we going at a moderate pace in 2010, and then we hit some bumps from Europe, from Japan, from gas prices, from debt ceiling negotiation, those things slowing us down? Or are we more like these countries that have gone through massive financial crises like Japan in the 90s? You got some economists arguing it's just going to be many, many years before we're back on a growth path. Now, I personally don't think that's true, but we certainly got to look at how much deleveraging has taken place and how much has got to continue to take place.
Yeah, deleveraging, that's a fancy way for moving away from debt. And at the personal level, consumers using debt more wisely.
Yeah, and if people have to get their debt levels down by a tremendous amount, that can sometimes take a while. Now, the good news, much of the pain that we had to go through to do that, we've now already gone through. So a lot, if not all, of the deleveraging for many consumers already took place. They just had to bite these awful bullets.
So we've been through this period of pain, and it's one way to look at it is at least the pain is behind us, not in front of us. But, you know, there's still potential for cheap money to swirl through our economy in ways that get us back into debt. I mean, look at the Fed with its low, longer-term interest rate policy. There's the potential here for bringing debt back into the equation and fueling the economy the old-fashioned way, you know, debt to consumers who then spend.
I would say that if you were in a normal time and you said unemployment's 9% plus, core inflation's well below the 2% target level, everybody would say, boy, it sounds like you want a loose monetary policy. So I don't fault central bankers around the world for taking a posture that's about growth. We've just got to shift our focus away from the consumers and consumer debt to business investment and export growth. It's not just what we want to do. That's what the market's going to be pushing us to do.
Now, I just want to understand this better before I let you go, which is, we have a lot of companies in the U.S. sitting on a lot of money. We'd like them to be investing them to help with growth. There's a lot of caution out there. What needs to happen now or soon to get those companies to start using the money?
Well, I'd say, I mean, one thing to note is companies had started accumulating money well before this recession began, interestingly. And there was a puzzle among the economic community of why are firms accumulating so much cash. In my read and talking to a lot of CEOs is that there's a great deal of fear and uncertainty about the state of the world and the state of the economy. And until they're feeling that the economy is back to a steadier growth path, they're going to still sit and wait before they're going to actually start spending the money.
So hopefully soon, right?
Yeah, hopefully soon.
All right. Austin Goolsbee, I want to thank you for this. This is extremely helpful to us. I really appreciate it.
Great talking to you again.
Austin Goolsbee is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Last year, about one in four adults under 65 had medical debt, an all-time high for the country. That's because health care costs continue to rise at the same time people are losing their jobs and health coverage.
Millions of people, they may not know this, but they are just one accident or one illness away from disaster.
This man's life was dramatically changed last year by medical debt. Kelly Weiss has his story.
A few years ago, things were going well for Andy G. He was a self-employed computer programmer in San Francisco. G was an active guy. He was always riding his bike or taking dance lessons. Then this.
I was coming north this way. He was coming west. And he hit me right there.
He points to an intersection just a few blocks from his apartment. Last October, he was riding home on his motorcycle, and an uninsured driver ran a stop sign and plowed right into him. G says just like that, his life changed. As he lay on the ground, he knew the bone sticking out of his leg was really bad. But through the pain, he thought, at least I have health insurance.
I wasn't even worried when I first got the bill from the hospital because I thought, hey, insurance is going to take care of this.
He was rushed to San Francisco General Hospital and had emergency surgery. He had to stay at the hospital for 6 days. Andy says it all added up.
I had no idea that I would end up owing this amount of money.
His provider, Blue Cross, said the charges were above the customary rate and it wouldn't pay all of them. The hospital and physicians group wouldn't budge. This left G responsible for the difference, $72,000. He was unemployed and getting over his surgery, and the medical bills just kept coming.
The first phase, as I'm sure you know, is denial.
He says for months he just pretended nothing was happening. Now he spends hours every day trying to get help on the bills and to stop the collection notices.
I've been feeling just so much anger from this whole thing of, you know, why did I get hit? And then, why are you sending me to collections? Why don't we try to work something out?
G worries his debts will wipe out the savings that he's been living on and ruin his credit score. He doesn't sleep well. And as he's tossing and turning late at night, he might flip on the TV and find this.
Just imagine if you could find a way to wipe out your medical debt in 12 to 36 months. That's right.
Imagine is right. These types of programs typically charge hefty fees to negotiate discount payments with creditors. Rob Quinlan is a debt counselor with the nonprofit ClearPoint Financial Solutions. He says there's no guarantee these programs will work, and you could just lose your money. Still, Quinlan acknowledges they're tempting for many people. Right now, a quarter of his clients are struggling with medical debt, and it's increasing.
Because of the recession and unemployment, certainly there are those that are having more medical debt and then using what they feel are the options to cover those debts.
Some of those options, payday loans and credit cards. He says taking on new debt to pay off old debt is a bad move.
Once you have medical debt that is ongoing, it can be a domino effect.
People do turn to credit cards when they're in this situation. That's according to Mark Rukavina. He's with the health advocacy group, The Access Project.
What we've seen over the past few years is that people put these medical expenses on their credit cards. And oftentimes, the problem magnified because of penalties, late fees, and interest charged on those bills.
And Rukavina says medical debt can hit anyone. In fact, about two-thirds of people with it have health insurance. Patients with insurance have to pay more in copays these days. And Rukavina says many buy plans that offer little coverage because that's all they can afford.
Unfortunately, more and more Americans understand this isn't a problem that's isolated to those without insurance.
This is something people with medical debt understand too well. In Sacramento, I'm Kelly Weiss for Marketplace Money.
This story was produced in collaboration with the California Healthcare Foundation's Center for Health Reporting. Since the story first aired on KQED Public Radio, the hospital has relented and given Andy G a 75% discount on his bill. Now he's working on getting a further discount on the remaining balance of $15,000. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Economy4_O. Economy 4.0 coverage on Marketplace is about ways to make the economy of the future better serve more people. Next time on this program...
What we found is that over rolling 20-year periods of time, historically, 70% of the time, I would have ended my 20-year period with more money doing the lump sum than dollar cost averaging in.
The pros and, yes, cons of the strategy called dollar cost averaging. Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm David Brancaccio. Tess Vigeland, I promise, we'll be back next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.